thank you, all of you who worked to make me work to come over. A lot of work for me. But it's a pleasure to be here, pleasure to see old friends like Majid. When you grow up trained as a physicist, neither poverty nor development exist in your mind, your life, your thinking, your training, because they are totally constructed. And of course, the constructions are many. The constructions of poverty and the constructions of development. I have grown up used to the idea that one should stay simple, that simplicity is the highest evolution of human living. My country, its culture, the civilization was known for this one thing, that we aspired towards simplicity. And the less you had, the more you were respected. The people who counted for most in society were the ones who'd given up everything in terms of material wealth. The rishis, the munis, who moved into the caves, moved into the forests. And they're the ones who could call on kings to do or not do certain things. Theirs was the last word in terms of decision making, precisely because they had left any interest in material rewards. But even when we fought for independence with ideas like those that Gandhi brought to our freedom movement, it was again with simplicity as a weapon that we dealt with colonialism and imperialism. So for us, poverty was a very positive word of chosen austerity, chosen simplicity. Both because to leave a small footprint on this planet is the only way one should be living. And also because it was so clear that if you consume more than you need, you are taking someone else's share, some other species' share, some other human being's share. So our ancient texts like the Upanishads say that very clearly, if you consume more than you need, you're stealing because you're taking someone else's share. And Gandhi left us with that phrase that has been quoted again and again and again, that the world has enough for everyone's needs, but it doesn't have enough for some people's greed. Now that positive interpretation of poverty as chosen simplicity has had many assaults. And one assault has been the way we have defined development, and I'm sure Majid's talk in this series would have touched on some of this. I have talked about this as culturally perceived poverty, where development consultants fly into India in the 60s and say, oh, they don't have pesticide factories. Therefore, they're poor and therefore they're underdeveloped. Very different reaction from Sir Albert Howard, who is known worldwide now as the father of modern organic farming. And he was sent to India in 1905. And he and his wife realized very quickly that he was sent as the imperial agriculturist. And the job given to him was improving Indian agriculture, which means introducing all the gadgetry to agriculture, the gadgetry of sprays, the gadgetry of fertilizers. And he realized very quickly that there were no pests on which he should be spraying, and the soil fertility was fine. So the soils didn't need the synthetic fertilizers. And he wrote then a book that has become a classic in the organic movement. It's called The Agricultural Testament. And there's a part in it I love, in which he talks about how to understand how to do good farming. He decided to make the pests and the peasants his teachers, because it was the peasants who were pests who were going to tell him how to do good pest control. And he threw away his spray guns, he threw away everything that he had carried with him to introduce into Indian agriculture. But I remember in the 60s, document after document talking about how Indian farming had no pesticides, and that was treated as an indicator of underdevelopment and poverty. Absence of plastics. You know, the idea of development was, of course, sown in 1948. That's those of us which had been ex-colonies were now defined as underdeveloped. But the projects for development, the big money to move that project, really came after the oil money, after the rise in the oil prices, much of which had to be then invested overseas. And the 60s and 70s saw that huge investment by the World Bank and IMF. And in that period, if you read the development literature and you see what are the indicators they are using for underdevelopment of countries, they're actually indicators of ecological sophistication. They're saying, these countries don't use enough plastics. Look at how much America uses, look at how little India uses. Paper, fossil fuel, synthetic chemicals, everything that good societies can do very well without. But that cultural perception of poverty, of course, was not just defined because of a cultural definition of what it meant to be poor. There were economic interests behind it. There were interests wanting to sell the plastics, the wanting to sell the pesticides. I know there's a person, I have never met him. He's an anonymous voice at the other end of BBC debates for me. I can't remember his name just now. But he's the author of Saving the World with Plastics and Pesticides. I'm sure you'll know who he is, but he defends GMOs. So there was that whole interest group that thought that by talking about our poverty, they could create their markets. And that hasn't stopped. It's still always our poverty that is the excuse to push every undesirable element in society. The most recent debate around genetic engineering. So far, there is no genetically engineered crop or plant that improves anyone's lives. The two sets of applications that exist are herbicide-tolerant crops and BT toxin crops. Now, the herbicide-tolerant crops have only one property of being resistant to herbicides, which means you can spray more herbicides. And of course, the real reason why these were evolved was because Roundup, the patent for Roundup was going to run out in 2000, and there was a need to have a lock-in for the farmers so that they would continue to use Roundup. And the design for that dependency was created through the genetically engineered crops. The second generation of genetically engineered crops is crops called the BT crops with BT toxins in it. And so the plant literally behaves like a pesticide factory, releasing toxin all the time. It's known that this toxin will do things to other species. Nobody's really studied enough what it does to our health, but we know it kills beneficial species. The monarch butterfly study was one. Indian trials have shown 300% increase in other pests, because when you change the plant, you change its behavior, you change its vulnerability, and putting a toxin in for one pest, called the bollworm, ends up creating new assaults by the aphids and jacids. But the part I love in the Monsanto trials in India about why there is no impact on beneficial species is because they started with fields that had no spiders. And they put the crop, and there were no spiders to kill. So there were zero spiders to begin with and zero spiders to end with, therefore no impact. And all of the genetic engineering research, there's a very, very good book, I recommend it to you very strongly it's called Seeds of Deception. These issues are going all the way to the World Trade Organization on May 23rd, 2003. President Bush proposed an initiative to end hunger in Africa using genetically engineered crop, and then he blamed Europe for making Africans starve by not eating GM crops themselves. By May 19th, a case had been filed, and Robert Zoellick, the U.S. trade representative, talked about overwhelming scientific research showing that biotech foods are safe and healthy, and that overwhelming scientific research is all documented in terms of how every step there was manipulation. It got so bad with this new dispute that has been brought against Europe to force Europe to import and eat genetically modified foods. The European Commissioner for Environment, her name is Margaret Wallstrom, a few weeks ago, she said of the U.S. biotech companies and President Bush, and this is the Environment Minister of the European Union, it is not a Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth activist. They tried to lie to the people. They tried to force it on people. It is the wrong approach. She ridiculed the U.S. claims that GM was about feeding the hungry. It will solve starvation among shareholders, but not the developing world. And of course, you know, the really interesting thing is that even though there's been manipulation of research wherever this issue has come up, in India, we've had the first set of commercial plantings of BT cotton. Again, in the name of making Indian peasants millionaires, yeah, all the advertisements is about you will be a millionaire. The promise was farmers would get 10,000 rupees additional incomes per acre. They'd get 1,500 kilograms of yields per acre. Farmers got 200 kilograms of yields on an average. They lost 6,500 rupees an acre. Now, about 100 studies in India show this, including 20 agriculture university studies, government of agriculture reports, etc., etc., etc. But the journal called Science publishes a paper saying the Indian yields doubled. Now, the two scientists were not in India to study the farmers' fields. They got their data from Monsanto. And in that book, Seeds of Deception, that's exactly what happened with recombinant bovine growth hormone. That's what happened at every level, where the so-called study was a study using the data the company had provided. And at the end of it, when the issue of science, the issue of knowledge, when it became tricky because there was some evidence, then of course our poverty is always brought up to justify every issue. The most recent use of our poverty is globalization, the WTO agreements. It's supposed to be about moving us out of $1 a day existence. I remember when globalization first started to get introduced in India, and one of our prime ministers, Narasimha Rao, was on a campaign trail talking about how if India got globalized and integrated into world market, people would have dollars in their pockets. And women stood up in peasant meetings and said, "You're forgetting we deal in rupees and we women have no pockets." You know, that the whole criteria and yardstick use was so off the mark. But in any case, this whole dollar a day thing, which is, if you look at the millennium, you know, the commitments of the millennium goals of the UN of after 50 years, how everything would be halved, everything is based on a dollar a day. I come from the Himalaya, and even today, there are villages in the high mountains who have zero cash income. But they are not poor for that. They have good woolens. This nice pashmina I'm wearing is made in one of those high mountain villages. can keep you warm, even in the snows. Beautiful homes, lovely structures that protect you from climates that's not as comfortable as your lovely Claremont climate. Food, nutritious foods, clean water. To me, those are the indicators of whether you have the good life or you don't. Now, without a dollar a day, you can have the good life if your ecosystems have not been spoiled, your rivers flow, your forests are intact, your agriculture has not been destroyed, your knowledge has not been eroded, your rights have not been taken away, and your culture gives you the means and mechanisms to organize life in a way that gives dignity to all. On the other hand, I was just thinking, a dollar a day as a measure of poverty, how far would a dollar a day take you in this country? You know, I'm sure all the series of talks you've had on poverty in this country, I don't even know what's the poverty level. $30, $40, $50? $27 a day. Well, I remember, you know, when I had my son and he was not even one, and I had a very prestigious invitation from a Swedish university to come and do a visiting professorship. So I thought, I'd just left university and I was setting up my independent institutions. And I support these institutions by teaching and writing, etc. So I said, oh, this will be very good. I spend the summer there. I'll come back with enough money to support the institution for a year. I've never been poorer. Because I had to pay two-thirds of what I earned straight for a rent. Straight. Half of the rest went to the babysitter. Now, I've never needed a babysitter in India. When I used to teach, I didn't have to worry about where my baby would be left because somebody would come in the morning and say, can we take him today? And I would never have to think of where I will find him at night when I come back because I knew I could be safe, that someone in the community would be treating him like their own child. The childcare has never been, in society, an individual responsibility. That is something totally recent, a product of urban industrial civilization. You know, children belong to all. And the moment you have to start paying for childcare, it becomes so costly to have a child that you end up, as you have in industrialized countries, not having kids. It's too costly to have a kid. So poverty is very, very much a function of what are, on the one hand, at the ecological level, what are your systems of access and entitlements to the vital resource that make life happen? Your soil, your water, your biodiversity, out of which livelihoods are created with no capital. The only capital you need is nature's capital. And even today, I would imagine 80% of humanity, if it is meeting its needs, it's when it has that access to that capital. And when that access to that capital is destroyed in the name of bringing development, that's when real poverty starts. Till then, it's purely culturally defined poverty. You know, the other day someone said to me, you know, I'm wearing a good enough sari, but someone, I was in some fancy meeting in Europe, and a journalist says, you come to these very important meetings, why don't you wear pants? And I said, why would I wear pants? What's wrong with a sari, you know? To me, to have the sari is a much better set piece of clothing, comfortable. I really think pants are like prisons. You know, they're clothing prisons. You know, to wear 6 yards into which you can expand limitlessly. But that cultural poverty of, you know, whether you wear pants or a sari defines whether you're poor or rich. And just as an afterthought, remembering, every time I've been to Africa in recent years, it's always pained me to see, in India, the peasants will wear their little lungi, their little dhoti, a piece of cloth that's theirs, has dignity, matches the climate. And very often in Africa, you see people wearing, all these Goodwill and Salvation Army clothing that's sent, and then, of course, sold. But someone's rejected, leftover clothes. And as the so-called development grows, you in fact see more and more of that happen. And that real poverty is not just a poverty of material existence. It's a cultural poverty, it's a spiritual poverty, it's a psychological poverty. People used to ask me, when I was doing my graduate work 30 years ago, and people would ask me about India, and I said the thing that's to me most precious about my country is no matter where you go, you can go to a slum, you can go to a village, there's a sparkle in the eye. People had a light in the eye. And then when you get the creation of real poverty, which I call misery and dispossession, it's very different from chosen austerity. This is real dispossession, where people have no clothing, have no home, have no water, have no community, have none of that which makes a life. That real dispossession is, of course, growing, and it is growing precisely in proportion to the processes that are being put in place in the name of removing it. Because these many concepts of poverty are getting mixed up. In the name of bringing food, real food systems are being destroyed. In the name of bringing education, real adapted education is being destroyed. But the most important base that is the prevention of real material poverty that's being destroyed is both the actual status of ecosystems, environmental resources, as well as the entitlements to them. Let me just give you two or three examples of the way real poverty has been created in the name of removing poverty. And in the name of creating growth, because the story really is, people are poor because they don't have money. Create growth, there'll be more money, bigger cake to share. When the cake grows and there's more growth, there'll be less poverty. It's as mechanical as that. Well, it doesn't work for a number of reasons. The first is because that growth destroys the very base through which people meet their needs. The second is, most of the time, that growth means that growth ends up exactly like it has in this country. You know the figures better than me about the disproportionate wealth polarization that has happened. Well, way back in the 70s, and that was really the beginning of my environmental engagement, the forests of the Himalaya were being logged in the name of creating growth. It started to lead to landslides. It started to lead to drought. It started to lead to women walking longer miles for water, for firewood. And the women came out and started the movement that became very, very global in its inspiration, the Chipko movement, hugging the trees. And the first arrests in Chipko were on the grounds that the women were blocking growth and revenue. And the women came out. I remember a particular action that really tilted the whole thing. They came out with lanterns in the daytime, and I've told this story in Staying Alive. And the police said, you crazy women, you're bringing lanterns in the day. Don't you see there's daylight? They said, no, it's not for the sun we bring the lantern, it's for you. Because you don't seem to know that the real product of forests is not your revenues. The real product is the soil and the water and the air. And I remember in those days, people said, oh, soil, water, we can understand, but this air business, isn't it a bit far-fetched? Well, not after climate change. You know, all the work on carbon sinks is related to the recognition that forests and trees and plants are our best sinks of carbon. One of the first projects introduced into India at the time of the new economic policies that were based on trade liberalization, globalization, or the imposition, you know, basically the neoliberal policies, was a World Bank loan to introduce industrial shrimp farming along the 7,000-kilometer coastline of India. It's not the case that we haven't farmed shrimp before. In Kerala, there has been an ancient system called Cheminketu, brilliant system, in which in the monsoon, when the waters come, the water is used for growing paddy because the salinity is low. And in the rest of the year, when the salinity goes high, those same ponds and lakes are used to grow shrimp. The biomass left from the rice gives food to the shrimp in the next season. And the droppings from the shrimp give fertilizer to the rice. So without any external input, perennially you can keep the cycle of shrimp and rice going. Well, it was considered as low productivity because shrimp was the high global commodity, whereas the rice was used by local people. So the World Bank gave huge loans, and before we knew it, the entire coast was pockmarked with these industrial ponds. And, you know, water is supposed to go from the land to the sea, but now water was being brought to the, from the sea to the land so that you could set up these seawater ponds to put the shrimp in. And I'm not going to give you details of the fact that, you know, to get pregnant shrimp to spawn, they don't spawn in captivity. They're freedom lovers. They'll only spawn in freedom. So they pull the eyes out of the pregnant shrimp so that they can lay the eggs and stock these ponds. And then because they want to produce more shrimp, they've got to give intensive feed. And it's such a wasteful process. 15 times more fish is used to feed the shrimp than is produced. 87% of that feed is pollution. And that pollution is then thrown back into the sea that kills the rest of the sea life, kills the creeks. In addition, you've brought salt water on the land, which starts to leach out. And before you know, it's killing your paddy fields, it's killing your coconut groves, it's killing all life around. And the women of the coastal area started a campaign in which I helped them. We got a Supreme Court order to ban this activity. And again, this whole issue of poverty and development came up because the figures thrown up by the industry, by the bank, were the trade figures of what was traded when shrimp was brought to your tables. What was never talked about was the figures of the destruction of what was left behind. And we did those studies for the Supreme Court case. For every dollar traded in shrimp, $10 of destruction was left in the local economy and the local ecology. For every job created in the shrimp industry, 15 livelihoods were destroyed in the local economy. And one could do this for every activity that is supposed to bring commercial activity, therefore growth, therefore supposedly a removal of poverty, but it creates, out of situations where people are meeting their needs, it creates a combination of dispossession and displacement, of real poverty. At the end of it, what you have is a situation where ordinary communities who could have met their needs, were meeting their needs, are now economic, social, and ecological refugees. The dam building in India has created 50 million ecological refugees. And now there is a proposal to create a $200 billion project to divert and link rivers with canals that would leave no space to stand on, with dams that would flood out what remaining forests and good agriculture survives in the country. All of these projects do bring growth as measured in the typical accounting systems. What it doesn't measure is the destruction of that natural capital that is the real solution to meeting people's need for food, for water. And as real scarcities have been created as a result of maldevelopment, as a result of ignoring nature's economy and ignoring people's economy, and in people's economy, ignoring particularly the women's economy. Because if you come to basic needs, you ultimately, it's women who run the economy, whether it's food or water or seed or fuel. Who's providing it in third world situations? It's the women. But that's the economy that's not noticed, that's not registered. I had a debate with McKinsey, the big consultancy firm. They put out a huge report for India, and the first line was, India only processes 1% of its food. And I asked them about, are we eating the rest of the 99% raw? And they said, no, only 1% is processed at the industrial level. Well, 1% was processed at the industrial level because we had a very sane, sensible policy which realized that food processing was best done at the local level. That's where safety was guaranteed. That's where livelihoods were guaranteed. So if you see up, these lovely papars you eat in Indian restaurants, you couldn't make papars in the industrial sector. You couldn't make pickles in the industrial sector. Now Nestle sells us mother's pickle. I was reading on my flight over that Lever's is going to package under its trade name Nor some fish paste that the Vietnamese make. The entire food processing issue is such a clear example of total negation of women's creativity, work, and knowledge. It leaves the women who are robbed of their livelihoods when that moves, that production. If, for example, milk production, the biggest milk economy of the world is India. 100% of the milk production in India is in the hands of women. None of it is in a factory condition. A woman will have one buffalo, one goat, one cow, and that's the base of this giant-sized dairy industry, which now the global industry has set its eyes on and would like to be able to take over. The women lose their jobs. Unhealthy products start getting substituted. And you have all the results to see. In England, there was the mad cow. Totally a result of moving food and feed out of local domains. Nobody knows what they're feeding these cows anymore. And it's ground up, diseased, infected cattle. And they had this word for it called rendering. And I'm always very suspicious when they have an incomplete phrase, rendering what into what. Then I'd know. But they just say rendering. It's just like economies in transition. Transition from where to where? But these sort of hanging verbs, have become so convenient to describe processes which no one ever really figures out. They just assume, it's from something bad to something good, not the other way around. But if you've heard Gorbachev, whose economy is supposed to be in transition, he said when we got rid of communism, we thought we would have democracy. But instead, what we have is mafia rule. So that word of economies in transition never said economies in transition to mafia rule, because people would have made other decisions if they'd known. In a way, it's similar doublespeak being used to take away the last resources on which people who are called poor depend for a life of dignity and a life of security. And these last set of resources are water, biodiversity, and food. Most of my last 15, 16 years have been spent on trying to defend both the biodiversity itself, the rights people to have access to it, and resisting the monopolies over biodiversity through the twin mechanisms of patenting and intellectual property, which would make seeds, genes, animals, plants, the exclusive monopoly of corporations. And when we are talking exclusive monopoly, let's not forget that today 93% of all genetically modified seed planted anywhere in the world is Monsanto seed. One company. It could be cotton, it could be corn, it could be potato, it's Monsanto. So we are talking about monopolies of the scale we have never known. The interesting thing is these monopolies are being introduced in yet another element of doublespeak, which is called competition. Yeah? So if in India 750 million farmers are saving their seed and have total freedom to save, exchange, improve their seed, create wonderful varieties like Basmati, that is not competition. That is a monopoly. 750 million free farmers are a monopoly. One Monsanto entering the scene is competition. As a result of those changes, Monsanto has come into India, bought up every private seed company, and then pushed the policy system exactly like your system has been pushed to cut down on welfare. There is this artificially created social poverty, public poverty, that takes finances away from public expenditure. Our public seed banks have closed, so Monsanto comes in with these wonderful ads, and all our gods are used as salesmen. And depending on the region, the advertising companies, I must say, are very, very smart. They do homework. So they know that in the east, it's Jagannathan, Lord Jagannath. In north, it's Punjab, it's Guru Nanak. And you go south, it works to have Hanuman do your marketing for you. As a result of this, let me just run through a few figures for you. As a result of these seed monopolies, increased expenditures on seed, increased locking in of seeds with chemicals and more expenditure on that, the debts that farmers have accrued are so high they can't pay them back. 25,000 farmers have committed suicide, a phenomenon not known in India before. Farmers are selling kidneys to pay back debt. Of course, they're having to sell their land and their cows and the buffaloes. And when they get too desperate, they drink the same pesticides. Drinking pesticide is the most frequent method for committing suicide in farm deaths. And then these miracle seeds that gods are selling are not performing the miracles they were supposed to. So the farmers of South India have lost last year 1 billion rupees worth of a crop in cotton. And in North India, Monsanto sold hybrid corn because they're not allowed to sell genetically engineered corn yet. They haven't got a permission. But the hybrid corn failed totally in the entire North Indian belt, leaving farmers with losses of $4.6 billion. So just in two seeds in 1 year, added to this is the fact that the whole globalized trade system is nothing but taking away the incomes of the poor. It could be incomes of the poor working in agriculture in the third world. It could be incomes of the poor working in any sector anywhere in the world. But the entire globalized trade system and the so-called free trade system, I see it as nothing but freedom to rip off the worker. And in the case of agriculture, you must have heard the Cancun failure, the big debates around that. the committing of a, you know, the farmer Lee, the Korean farmer committing suicide, carrying a banner saying WTO kills farmers, and it's no more metaphorical. It's no more dramatic. It is real. Our figures show, and we've done very detailed study in sector by sector about what these liberalized trade rules do in terms of depressing prices and what those levels of increased poverty, of real poverty now, imply. It's about 50% to 70% of rural incomes have been robbed in the last few years. For India, our figures are $26 billion per annum. $26 billion per annum in terms of lost incomes, real poverty. And you just have to look at the case of coffee. More and more trade in coffee, more and more consumption of coffee. The trade has doubled from 40 to 70 billion. And while the trade has doubled, the incomes of producers have dropped from 9 to 5 billion. And in Nicaragua and Colombia, the farmers who were growing coffee are starving. They're destitute. Every few weeks, there's some report on coffee growers not being able to survive, not being able to live. That's a real poverty. So if every fourth farmer is an Indian farmer, and Indian farmers are losing $25 to $26 billion a year across all farming communities, farmers are losing $1 trillion a year. That's losses in agricultural incomes. Move to the patenting issue. The fact that crops, seeds, knowledge we have evolved, the neem, the basmati, now the wheat. As these plants and seeds are patented, as seed becomes a marketable commodity owned as private property through intellectual property rights, the figures are industry figures. They talk about a $1 trillion market through intellectual property rights and plant genetic resources. Now, a $1 trillion market for Monsanto means $1 trillion poverty for the farmers who now pay for what belonged to them, their own seed. That commodification is a new poverty. Water privatization, again a figure generated by the water companies themselves. There are five water companies. Well, actually, there are five everything. It's a magical number. There are five grain trading companies, Cargill, Conagra, ADM, Bunge. You know those names. They are everyday names for you. They are strangers for us. We're getting to know them now. But for you, they've been around for a long time. Biotechnology, there used to be five, but in a way the others are waiting in the wings while Monsanto does the dirty work for everyone. And then they'll come out. Then the Syngentas and all will come out. Meantime, it's only Monsanto. But the concentration is huge. There used to be Sandoz, Ciba-Geigy, Astra, Zeneca, four different giants. All chemical giants, pharmaceutical industry, agrochemicals. They bought up the seed companies, they bought up the biotech companies. Five giants now control all health, all medicine, all seed, all agrochemical. So all our entire food and healthcare in the hands of five giants, who then want the right to sell medicines that can be sold for $100, $200 at $20,000, $30,000. That's the debate in WTO on AIDS. That's the debate in your Medicare and the old people not being able to afford drugs. It's the same debate everywhere. Now, for the old person in this country, not having access to medicine is poverty. Just as for that patient of AIDS dying in Africa for being forced into a denial for something that should be accessible is also a vicious creation of poverty. The five giants in water are Suez, Vivendi, Bechtel, RWE, Thames. Enron, Monsanto tried to be there. Enron, you know where it went. Monsanto, I guess, is just holding out to see if it survives seed, then it'll get into water. But this seed industry, in World Bank analysis, through World Bank analysis, has said, if water is privatized, commodified, the water market, which means for every drop of water we drink, and, you know, Coca-Cola has a slogan, it's, you know, at its board meetings of 2-3 years ago, they said, every day, how many billion of us there are, goes thirsty a number of times a day. Our objective has to be that at no point can any human being quench their thirst without Coca-Cola. Now, that $1 trillion market that's being seen in terms of privatized water, whether it's privatization through bottling or privatization through municipal supplies, etc., all of that means people pay more. I'll just give you two quick stories. In India, Coca-Cola is, of course, setting... I know they were thrown out in 1977 for fudging with their taxes, etc. But they came back under globalization. And now they are mining water wherever they can set up. And down south in Kerala, women are fighting. 1.5 million liters of water being mined daily has left a 10-mile radius totally without water. And water privatization is not just a problem in rural communities like the community in Kerala in Plachimada. I remember in the water privatization campaign, I think it's one of the northern cities, I think it's Detroit, where water was privatized, the women who had been put off welfare couldn't pay. 50,000 disconnections, lines were disconnected, no access to water. In rich, powerful America, the poor have no access to water under privatization. So if you add the three sectors that are absolutely vital to living, you've got $3 trillion of new poverty. But this new poverty is a different kind of poverty because it's not just leaving you with less, with which people have learned to cope amazingly. It is leaving you with nothing. It's leaving you with no means to live. And that is why I say what used to be the polarity and inequality of the haves and have-nots has been mutated into a new polarity of the live and live-nots. And inequality now is written in terms of some people having no right to live on this planet. I believe that's unacceptable. I believe everyone born has equal rights to live. It doesn't matter what their gender, doesn't matter what their race, doesn't matter what their religion, doesn't matter where they were born. The planet, as Gandhi said, gives enough for everyone to meet their needs. And if today the right to life is being taken away, it's not being taken away because there aren't enough resources in the world. It's being taken away because of a greedy economic system based on organized greed as the only principle there is, there's nothing else, which is treating everything as a commodity, is everything being for sale, but when everything is for sale, life becomes too expensive. You can't buy life. You can live life. You can't afford to buy every drop of water you drink, every morsel of food you eat, at a time when every livelihood option is also being shut out, so that your entitlements are not being worked out also through incomes. And that is why in response to this world order, which is a world order of creating real poverty by taking away the real wealth of people and leaving them with nothing, when the slogan of that world order is everything is for sale, the global movement, which has been resisting WTO and this commodification, basically says our world is not for sale. That's the theme around which we organize. And I try and articulate this both at the level of actions on the ground as well as ways of thinking of a period beyond globalization. And I like to think of it in terms of an earth democracy in which all of us are citizens along with other beings and other species. And our rights to live with dignity and love and compassion are rights given from nature and creation, not rights written by states or rights that can be extinguished and robbed by a handful of corporations. Thank you.
Bad children, they are our governments.
I think, you know, what's very often forgotten is WTO is nothing but our governments in membership in one multilateral body, which then gets used and misused in all kinds of ways. But the reason I am at these meetings is to remind our government about their duties under our democratic institutions and our constitution, in a way to be their conscience, partly also to be the source of information. The reason, if you look at the history of WTO, there was no agreement in the Uruguay round. And then the Europeans and US got together and hustled an agreement. It was called the Dunkel draft text, which we used to call DDT in India. And then we got the WTO, in a way without agreement. And the WTO was used to bully everyone. In Seattle, the movements had become alive to the issue. But meantime, the excluded countries were also alive to the fact that they weren't even being brought in, because three countries get in and say, we'll agree to this, and then come out and say, we've agreed. And the Africans said, but what about us? We are not going to be rubber stamps. So the combination of the protests on the street as well as the protest by the marginalized countries, especially Africa and the Caribbean, the small countries who have no trade interest for anybody. They're too tiny. They have nothing to export, no buying power. You know, India's middle classes are so huge. And India, 750 million peasants are the biggest market for the Monsantos. So India is always taken into the discussion. Brazil is taken in. But the small countries were left out, and they said no. Doha, there would have been no agreement. Right till midnight, our minister was saying, sorry, we are not going to allow a larger WTO. And then in the middle of the night, he got a call, and from what we've heard, it was a call, Washington to Blair, Blair to our prime minister to our minister, to basically say, by your fighting in WTO, you are breaking the coalition against terror. And in a way, the Doha Development Round, as it's called, was basically a blackmail round, using the terror issue to force a fake agreement. That's what was supposed to have now been finalized in Cancun. But every year, the impact of these agreements shows up more. You know, more and more countries are losing out, and now they're not willing to go along, especially in a one-sided implementation where, you know, you have a farm bill that has increased the subsidies to agribusiness. Steel tariffs is a big hot issue already now. All of this is showing two things. One, that free trade is a one-way street. The South should do free trade and remove restrictions, and the North can go along as it is. The way I look at it, you know, at this point, the institution has lost credibility, but it's necessary to do two or three things that IMF and World Bank can't do. IMF and World Bank cannot impose intellectual property. They can use financial conditionalities, but they can't impose intellectual property. And the second thing IMF World Bank can't do is create this whole global corporate-controlled agriculture. Those, I believe, are the two areas where the WTO is absolutely necessary. And you'll notice, even the free trade of the Americas failed in getting these two areas in, because these are the two most controversial areas. And the way we are dealing with it now is at two levels, continuing the movements, because our movements are movements of both building alternatives on the ground that make this whole system redundant to people's lives. Farmers saving seeds, setting up community seed banks, doing agriculture without their inputs, marketing locally, so you're not locked into their falling prices. All of that as alternatives. And the second is resisting, both locally, nationally, and globally. And in terms of the resistance, I hope I have carried this with me. We have two very creative international campaigns. One is in the GMO case of US against Europe. We are building up a citizens' challenge worldwide, including American citizens. The sign-on is at gmochallenge@yahoo.com. And the idea really is to begin an amicus saying, you call yourself a multilateral institution, next to WTO, but look how you're being used as a unilateral instrument of one company to force open markets and take away the democratic rights of people. We want this to be very big here in this country so that your rights to choose, which have never been discussed and debated, start becoming more active, that this case against Europe is not American citizens, against European citizens, and that your rights are violated just in the same way. But the second element of it is to really consolidate the 10 years of history of genetic engineering, including the fraud, including the deception, including the performance, etc., so that citizens actually have their own history. It's not available in one place. Africans have their experience, Indians have their experience, everyone has have fragmented experience. The second thing that I'm really excited about is doing a trade treaty, taking the earth, farmers, and food seriously. What would trade in agriculture look like if sustainability, food security, safety, farmers' livelihoods had to be taken into account? It's not too difficult to rewrite that agriculture agreement. But it will do two things. The movements building alternatives get strength, and the fraud of the WTO agreement starts to show. So one has to do whatever one can. There's no one miracle solution. The most important thing is the fact that there is no one way is precisely the reason that we are all free to create different ways that are appropriate to our conditions, our situations. And we have to engage because too much is at stake. Announce at the end, I'm going to leave our magazine, our journal with the Humanities Center because we, after 9/11 and other things, we've started a school for short courses for what I call Education for Earth Citizenship. And it's basically sort of very in-depth work with leading activist thinkers on these kinds of issues on our organic farm in Dehradun. So if any of you ever feel inclined traveling to India, you'll have the contacts right there at the center. And I'll also leave this our posters on what the Earth Democracy, Living Democracy movement and how we organize and think about it in terms of defending people's rights.